Hey, how's everybody doing? I hope you're having a fantastic day. So, unfortunately, today, Ethan will not be able to make it, and next time as well. But to make up for it, to kind of get past this beginning stage that we're in where we're going over the notions of everything, it's actually going to be a doubleheader this week. So, I'm recording this Saturday morning. Probably will release this Monday. I have the next episode already recorded. I know, weird, I recorded it backwards. It's because I thought Ethan was going to be here for this one, but, you know, work schedule and stuff like that happens. So this one, next one, will probably, I don't know, release it Wednesday, and then it might be a triple header, actually, now that I think of it, because if Ethan's free late next week, then we'll just do the 10th episode in the series. So you guys are real lucky this week, I guess. But since Ethan's not going to be here, there's going to be a lot less tangential sort of stuff that you guys love, where we connect it with other aspects. This is kind of just going to be me straightforwardly explaining what the chapter's talking about. Unfortunate, but, you know, it is what it is. So for chapter five, we're in chapter five now. Finally, almost done the notions to where we can get to actually defending the befittingness and possibility and such of revelation. Here we're going to be talking about dogma and mystery. So it may be strange to you at first that we're going to be putting dogma and mystery in the same chapter. Like, why wouldn't you just do different chapters for it? But this is actually extremely intentional on the part of Father Lagrange. So what is a mystery? Usually, when we speak about mysteries, we usually mean something that has some sort of hiddenness to it. And that's the general sort of common sort of notion that we're working off of when we talk about mystery. It's basically something which has some sort of hiddenness to reason, not only to an individual's reason, but to reason considered in itself, if you want to put it like that, or in our condition. So from this, we're actually able to have a twofold distinction: mystery in the broad sense and then mystery in the strict sense. So mystery in the broad sense is going to be something that is impervious to reason, that's above reason, but it's going to be something whose essence is not above reason. So for example, this makes a little bit more sense. The fact that Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD, that is something which before 70 AD was hidden to people's reason. But now that we're after the fact, we can easily understand it. So before, it was a mystery in the broad sense. Now we can understand it. Or really any of the decrees of God, we can think about it like this. Or something like the fact that we have a vicar of Christ. The fact that we have a pope. The fact that we have a pope, that's not something which is hard to understand, but it was something which was hidden before the revelation of the papacy in the New Testament. It's something which was hidden. So those are mysteries in the broad sense. We can also have mysteries in the strict sense. When it comes to mysteries in the strict sense, not only are they above reason as to their existence, like we talked about with the other ones, but also as to their essence. So they are above every intellect, both created and creatable, and they require revelation. So even the highest angel cannot know the existence or the essence of the Trinity without it being revealed to him. And then even then, as we'll talk about later, through analogical notions outside of the beatific vision, that is. So it requires revelation. It's above, it strictly exceeds every intellect which is creatable. And then what's also interesting is even after revelation, it's hidden. It's hidden in the sense that it can't be comprehended. So we can't comprehend it. Even in the beatific vision, we won't comprehend. comprehend as in exhaustively comprehend, to clarify. And then also it's hidden in the sense that we can't demonstrate it. We cannot demonstrate any of these things even after revelation. And then we're going to get into this, why this is going to be problematic for some thinkers in a minute. But next, so I sort of started this by indicating that it may seem to be a bit weird that we're talking about mystery and dogma, because the modernists will have you think that mystery and dogma are somehow opposed to one another. But really, what dogma is dogma is to a mystery as an assertion is to a thing asserted. So dogma is to a mystery as an assertion is to the thing asserted. So dogmas are the medium in which we understand the mystery. That's what a dogma is. A dogma is a statement of the mystery. And we can also, this isn't magisteriology, so I won't be getting into much detail about this. But yes, technically we can distinguish further into defined dogmas and such, but that's unimportant for right now. If you want to learn more about that, read something on magisteriology. This is just the sense of a dogma as an assertion of a mystery. So a dogma is distinct, though, and this is extremely important. This is going to help a lot with understanding the evolution of dogma in its proper sense. So dogma is distinct from a dogmatic formula. So dogmatic formula is the presentation of a dogma quid nos, so according to us, by the teaching church. So for example, the assertion, the word was made flesh, and the definition of Chalcedon on the incarnation, those are actually expressing the same exact dogma. But the dogmatic formula is something which has changed, whether it be through the clarification of definitions, whether it be through drawing forth some conclusions, and that's controversial, actually, which we'll talk about later. Actually, I won't really talk about it later in such. But dogmatic formula needs to be distinguished from a dogma, which needs to be distinguished from the mystery. All those need to be distinguished from one another. Very important. Okay, so now the heterodox notion. So this is typical. Garrigou talks about the Catholic notion, then talks about the heterodox notions to help us understand it more. But the heterodox notions are very helpful here. So we're going to have three errors on this point. So the first error is going to be the rationalists, the second are going to be the modernists, and the third are going to be the semi-rationalists. And unfortunately, a lot of people accidentally fall into the semi-rationalist camp, which you can gently inform them of this. You don't have to go beat them over the head and call them semi-rationalists and whatever. But so the first are rationalists. So rationalists, they think that the dogmas are unintelligible. So when we talk about the dogmas being incomprehensible or indemonstrable, they think that means unintelligible. So they think that the whole idea of a dogma expressing a mystery is nonsense and is some sort of natural symbol, which is what they call it. And then what's interesting is next comes the modernists. So the modernists, if you remember all the way back us talking about the modernists and their feels and all that junk and their religious sense, the modernists, they look sort of within ourselves and they say that actually what dogmas are, and unfortunately, it seems like there are a lot of Catholics, older Catholics, who speak this way. But dogmas are actually sort of symbolic representations of our interior sense, our sort of subjective religious experience. And that's what dogmas are expressing. So dogmas aren't expressing that objective truth out there, but rather, dogmas are expressing something psychological, if you want to put it like that. And then on, and then the in the third position are the semi-rationalists. So the semi-rationalists, they what they believed is they denied in a certain sense the indemonstrability of the dogmas. So they thought that after revelation, after one has assented to faith, that one could prove from natural reason the dogmas. So for example, and a lot of people do this with the Trinity. We have the Trinity. The Trinity is a mystery hidden from the ages, and it's revealed unto us in the Old Testament in a less clear manner, and then manifestly in the New Testament, it's revealed unto us. And then a certain believer assents unto it by the assent of faith. And then after that's been revealed to them, after they've assented unto the assent of faith, then they can take that and they can reason to it by their amazing logical skills. And they can prove the Trinity so that when they have all of the big brain people that they're meeting, all of the smart philosophers, and they're discussing the Trinity with them, they can actually prove the Trinity to all these smart philosophers. And the smart philosophers can then... they can use that as an apologetic tool. Completely bogus. Completely wrong. Not only does it make no sense objectively, because these are mysteries, and therefore definitionally cannot be known through the natural order, rather must be known through the supernatural order, which next episode on supernatural order, a lot of these things are going to click for you. Trust me. Not only that, junk on that end, but also on the end of the ascent of faith. Because as the Thomists affirm, one cannot have knowledge, scientia, and faith of the same object under the same respect. And since there's no natural aspect to the Trinity, so like, for example, when it comes to the existence of God, we can actually know his existence as creator and then his existence as author of the supernatural order. Again, next episode, that'll make sense. There's no natural aspect to the Trinity. So what you will be saying is manifestly incoherent, because you would be saying that somebody has both natural knowledge of the Trinity and supernatural knowledge of the Trinity under the same aspect. And you can't have faith and knowledge of the same thing under the same aspect. That's ridiculous. Those are mutually contradictory. So when you prove all of this to your friends, you kind of screwed them over, because now that they have knowledge of this under the aspect of natural truth, they can't make the ascent of faith. They can't do it. So yeah, obviously the semi-rationalist idea just leads to manifest absurdity. So now in the second article, he's going to get into a little bit of the theological explication of dogma and then the theological explication of mystery as well. So the first is going to be, and I pulled it up. The first is going to be the division. So first what we need to know is that basically when it comes to, if you want just kind of quick and easy distinction between the three types of heretics when it comes to this. So when it comes to the distinction between natural and supernatural mysteries, which we have here, the rationalists deny the distinction between natural and supernatural mysteries, which we're going to be talking about here. The semi-rationalists think it's a per accidens distinction. So, they think it's only something which is accidental, and actually the same intellect with the same powers can know both. It just happens to be tough luck. God has made it in such a way where we can't know the Trinity from natural reason for some reason until he tells us about it. You know, kind of like the destruction of Jerusalem. That we don't know that decree until afterwards. And then the Catholics, they think it's a per se, so an essential, an adequate distinction, which is based not on not on us, not on merely the will of God, but actually on the objects themselves, which is the teaching of Vatican I, by the way, which I think puts the scotistic view on this in jeopardy, whether one can hold it. Although that is a story for a different day. But the distinction that we have between the two is first natural mysteries, again, like the knowledge of God's decree to destroy Jerusalem, and such. So those are things which can be known without revelation, at least as regards its existence. We just aren't able to know it due to some sort of impediment. And the second, which is supernatural. So supernatural, which indeed cannot be known without revelation, even as regards its existence. So we actually need revelation with these. It's not just some sort of impediment. So under the first, I'll distinguish natural. So de facto hidden as regards its essence, and then hidden as regards its intimate essence. So when it comes to de facto hidden as regards its existence, I think I said essence twice. The first one, hidden in regards to existence. Second one, as regards to intimate essence. And then as existence of the physical order, so what things exist in the depths of the earth or of the sea. And the second of the intellectual moral order, so the secrets of the heart or secrets of a given religious society. So with those, as regards its existence, like, yeah, you don't know what happens on the bottom of the ocean. Like, you don't know what's there. You don't know what somebody's thinking. Things like that. The natural mysteries. And then secondhand, hidden as regards its intimate essence. So you know that it is. You just kind of have trouble with what it is. So relatively in regard to the human intellect. So this would be things that we have difficulty knowing, although angels wouldn't. So this would be in the created order. So the intimate nature of physical energy, nutrition, sensation, intellection, free choice, transitive causality, etc. So with these, basically, and actually, Gary Gu on his Sens Commun, he goes into detail. He has a very beautiful reflection on the relative, I don't even know what the technical term, the relative natural mysteries hidden as regards its intimate essence. That's kind of a mouthful. But he actually has a, in the created order, he has a really cool reflection on this, which is very great. Basically, like, we can barely know the actual essence, the real definition of a butterfly. Because we don't really know the specific difference of butterfly nest. We kind of know it's an animal and we know some of its attributes, but we don't really know the intimate essence of it. And then on the other hand, absolutely. So there are certain ones that are natural, but they cannot be known by any created intellect. So this would be the intimate reconciliation of the naturally knowable attributes of God, which this can lead to a very good reflection on the sort of limits of our knowledge when it comes to the multiplicity of perfections, which we attribute to God, and his intimate simplicity and his ultimate freedom and his determinateness and so on and so forth. But just read, let's see. If you go to his predestination, one of his chapters, he actually has a good one on how to apply these concepts of mystery to theology. It's like chapter 2, chapter 3, something like that. Very short. It's very good. So if you want to reflect more upon that, definitely check out that chapter. And then we also have the supernatural mysteries, as I talked about, which cannot be known without revelation, even as regards its existence. So on the one hand, we have broadly speaking, and the other hand, we have strictly speaking. So with broadly speaking, those are which do not remain obscure after revelation, but are easily understood. So the existence cannot be known without revelation, but the essence can be known without revelation. So divine decrees, basically, the fact that God has decreed that, let's say 20 years ago, that Jorge Bergoglio would be the Pope of the Catholic Church. That is a divine decree that is easily intelligible. But it's something which cannot be known without revelation. And then also its essence. So intrinsically supernatural mysteries. So the Trinity, incarnation, the life of grace, and so on. So the next section that he goes over after this has to do with the intelligibility, because if you remember, the rationalists, they had a big difficulty with the fact that we say that the mysteries are intelligible but incomprehensible. They think that those are, I need to pull something up, that those are contradictory. De filius, let me see. I think those are contradictory, but obviously that's ridiculous. Let me see. Boom, boom, boom. Sharing my screen. But this, okay, right there. So we say that the mysteries are indemonstrable, so that we can't prove it, neither a priori, a posteriori, or by a reductio ad absurdum. Those are the three modes, the two direct modes and the one indirect mode. In none of those ways can we prove, we demonstrate the mysteries. We can't do it. It's also incomprehensible, which means that we can't, not only when it comes to the existence, but also cannot know the notions completely. So let's say I will make it a little bit easier. So let's say I said that sanctifying grace is an entitative habit. Sanctifying grace is an entitative habit. Outside of revelation, I guess, supernatural entitative habit, whatever you want to say. With that, it's something which is indemonstrable and incomprehensible, but it's not unintelligible. Why is it not unintelligible? So there could be some sort of material understanding of this. So yeah, the idea of something gracious, yeah, the idea of an entitative habit, yeah, we can read Aristotle, understand what that means. The idea of supernatural even, yeah, we can kind of materially understand what that means. So it's not unintelligible. The words mean things, basically. The words mean things. But it's something which is incomprehensible. So that we can't exhaust the meaning of those words. It's indemonstrable, so that that is, sanctifying grace is an entitatively an entitative habit. So that is right there, the connection between the subject and the predicate. We cannot assent unto that by natural reason. We cannot prove that connection at all between the two. It needs to be something which is revealed. So that's what we mean by the fact that it is intelligible, but that it is indemonstrable and incomprehensible. And there is actually, very interestingly, we can take this this judgment right there, sanctifying grace is a supernatural entitative habit. We can take that and we can actually understand it more. So how do we understand it more? We don't understand it more by reason. Rather, as Vatican I is going to explain, this is very important. Indeed, reason illustrated or illuminated by faith, when it zealously, piously, and soberly seeks, attains with the help of God some understanding of the mysteries, and that a most profitable one. So first, very important, the principle by which we come to understand these mysteries is the intellect, which has certain supernatural habits. It's the habit of faith, the various gifts of the Holy Ghost that inhere in the intellect, especially the gift of wisdom, even something like the gift of prudence. These are all going to, they're all going to play in when it comes to being able to have some sort of understanding. So we can't just do it by natural reason alone. You can't just take natural reason and then have talk about analogies, talk about the interconnection and so on, and kind of make it work. It's not how it works. And it goes on, not only from the analogy of those things which it knows naturally. So the first way is the analogy of those things that it knows naturally. So think about what I just did when it comes to the various intellectual habits. I took something that I naturally know. So I naturally know that my intellect has a certain habit, which is ordered towards being under the aspect of knowableness. So I can think of, okay, the habit of science, the habit of wisdom, habit of prudence. I can think of these various natural habits that my intellect can have towards various different objects. Well, actually, objects under various different aspects. I can think of this, and I can say, wait, my intellect can be ordered towards supernatural truths as well. And my intellect can be ordered towards natural truths with a supernatural end as well. So I can take by analogy of those things which are created, I can have some sort of understanding with uncreated things. Same thing with the notions of essence, substance, person, change, so on, motion, so on. I can have understanding of all of these various different natural truths. And from those, I can have some sort of understanding by way of analogy of the supernatural mysteries. And then not only that, but also from the connection of these mysteries among themselves and with the last end of man. So it's interesting. So what we have is we have the ability to take all of these revealed objects, all of these, well, revealed judgments, all of these revealed judgments that we have, all of these dogmas, and we're able to order them together, just as we would take a natural science, say logic, and we would order it. We distinguish between material and formal logic. We distinguish between the first, second, and third acts of the intellect. And so we'd make all of these distinctions. We'd order them together properly. And with this ordering, we're drawing forth conclusions as well that necessarily follow. Drawing forth these conclusions, ordering together. And from this, we're able to fruitfully gain some sort of understanding of these. And I could keep going with this, but unfortunately, I have to go soon. But this is one of my favorite topics. Honestly, I would just recommend if you want a summary of De Revelatione, it's kind of funny because De Revelatione is just an explanation of this. Yeah, read De Filius, read it. Because really, all De Revelatione is just an explanation of this. Very good. It's very good. Where was I? Actually, it doesn't really matter where I was. Okay, so next we have to understand is, as I said above, dogmas are that through which we believe. So since we're going to have to take common notions with created things, these are necessarily going to be complex. So so we're going to understand a single simple object under various different notions. Not its single simple notion that we would understand through the beatific vision, for example. So because of this, this is why we can take something as simple as the idea that God became man, and we can write volumes and volumes and volumes about it. Because, for example, when we talk about humanity, it has different physical parts. And each one of these physical parts, there are certain things which are integral to it, certain things which are essential to it. And so on and so forth. So we can actually dive into and explain all of these, the various notions which come to us. So because of this, the dogmatic formulations are going to change over time. It's just how it is. But And this is what we call evolution of dogma, although I'm not going to go into Gary Gu's concept of evolution of dogma because I'm not sure how much I agree with it. But if you do want to go into, if you want to go into more of this topic, check out a series I did on Father Francisco Marinsola that I've kind of paused, although I want to get back into it. But yeah, check out my series from Father Sola. But basically, this helps us with understanding what is the difference between the revelation before Christ and then after Christ, and then the apostles to now. Because there are certain Catholic thinkers, Jimmy Akin, who want to, in order to express his idea of dogmatic development, his false idea of dogmatic development, not the true idea of dogmatic development like Father Sola had and Father Lagrange had, but in order to express his false idea of dogmatic development, he's going to basically say, oh, the transition from the belief on the church on icons in the first century to now is basically the same as the changing of the Mosaic code from then to now. I mean, from then to the revelation of the New Testament. Ridiculous notion. Because while the articles, so there's the same articles of the faith. So we have God as efficient cause of the supernatural order. So that God is. And then also God as final cause of the supernatural order. That he rewards those who he rewards those who seek him. So same articles, but from before Christ to after Christ, there are actually new dogmas. So there's new dogmas that are being revealed from before Christ to after Christ. But the relationship from the apostles to now, there are the same articles. So same articles then to same articles now. And then the same dogmas as well. But we can also talk of new formulations, new dogmatic formulations. We can talk about new theological conclusions. So we're drawing forth that which is virtually contained. And we can also talk about new defined dogmas in the sense that the church is defining those things which were already revealed as dogmas. So those are the only ways in which we can talk about dogmatic development happening from the apostles to now. Not new dogmas like there was from before Christ to after Christ. Okay, so I wish I could have said a lot more, but I do have to get going. As always, thank you. And